This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Oh, would there were a single game to settle all the doubt. If football had a championship, we'd surely be without the gap between the rich and poor, and we would surely see destruction of the weapons that have threatened you and me. No person would go hungry, and we'd study war no more. If there were just a championship, our spirits, how they'd soar. Or so argue those who'd like to see college football's top division adopt a playoff format and scrap the complicated and confusing mechanism called the Bowl Championship Series. Here to discuss this and other college football matters is Dan Wetzel of Yahoo Sports. Dan, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me back.
The 72nd Heisman Trophy is the first thing we're going to discuss. That'll be handed out today in New York. Three finalists will be present, but from what I gather, only one finalist really needs to show up, right?
Yeah, everyone. Troy Smith is going to win this thing, the quarterback of Ohio State. There's no question. Brady Quinn from Notre Dame and Darren McFadden, Arkansas, are there just to get a carriage ride around Central Park and go up in the Empire State Building. It's been a long time since there's this big of a landslide for Smith. He had a great season. Their team's number one and undefeated, and he's clearly the choice.
Troy Smith's Ohio State Buckeyes found out whom they will play in the Tostitos BCS Bowl this week. The computers, mathematicians, coaches, and writers decided that the second-best team in the nation was Florida. You agree?
I do agree. I think Florida had a better resume. They beat more teams that are very good than Michigan or Louisville, the other two teams that are shot, mainly Michigan. So I had no problem with that choice.
The Buckeyes are the heavy favorites, not surprising. Can you see the Gators somehow getting the upset in Glendale on January 8th?
Yeah, well, there's two reasons. One, Florida has a lot of very talented playmakers that can break a game open, particularly a freshman wide receiver running back named Percy Harvin, who in about 2 years you and I will discuss being the runaway landslide Heisman Trophy winner. He's a tremendous player. So Percy Harvin and a number of their players can make plays to make it close. The other thing is, in the one of the peculiar wrinkles of college football, Ohio State has 51 days off between their last game and the BCS title game.
Wow.
I know no other sport that says, let's take a couple months off and then settle this. Presumably it's so they can take finals, although if you've ever seen a graduation rate of college football, you'd know maybe
Ohio
they need
State
61 days.
Yeah, they ain't exactly at the top of the list, are they?
So you got 51 days off. You basically have 7 weeks off. Anything can happen. We have no idea what team is coming back and what team is going to show up. That always throws a wrinkle into this.
Dan, did you ever think that you would see the day where Michigan would be disappointed to play in the Rose Bowl against USC?
I did not think that would occur, although in recent years you could see why it would happen. Traditionally, particularly under Bo Schembechler, all Michigan ever wanted to do was go to the Rose Bowl and play USC. That was a good season, whether they were voted number one or not. Didn't really matter to them. In the current age, though, everybody wants the instant gratification. They want the finality. They want the American Idol-style winner, who won, who lost. And so the Rose Bowl, which will feature probably the third and fourth best teams in America, just isn't what it's cracked up to be. And Ohio State, which also always dreamed of the Rose Bowl, is quite glad they're not there.
Dan, your distaste for the Bowl Championship Series system is well documented, but at least one school thinks that that system is just fantastic, and that would be Boise State. They'll be making their first major bowl appearance. The Broncos of the Blue Turf, gee, I love that kind of talk, will face Oklahoma in the Fiesta Bowl. Will the state of Idaho be rejoicing in the new year?
Free potatoes for everybody.
That's celebration, man.
It is a great thing for Boise State. They were just a decade ago were a 1AA team, which is a lower division. And what they've done in building up their program is amazing. They have great players. Ian Johnson, their running back, is as good as Oklahoma's going to trot out there, most likely. Although they have a guy named Adrian Peterson, probably a little better. But this is a very, very good team, and it's a very good program. And a playoff would give Boise State a chance to try to win it. Win the national championship, although I think that would be unlikely. They're not good enough to beat the top teams, but this gives them a great test and puts, Boise, Idaho in the spotlight nationally for a little bit, and they deserve it. I think it's a great thing for Idaho. You don't get to say that very often.
Louisiana State will face Notre Dame in the Sugar Bowl, and that will be in the Louisiana Superdome for the first time since Hurricane Katrina. The fans in attendance will be overwhelmingly pro-LSU. Does that mean the Fighting Irish don't win?
Well, I think LSU wins because they have a better team. Notre Dame certainly has some excellent players in Brady Quinn and his receiver, Jeff Samardzija. But in terms of depth of talent throughout the program, they don't have what LSU has. And Notre Dame gets a lot of attention, and they get in these bowls because they're so popular. They'll get a television rating. They'll sell tickets to the historic program. But they really haven't beaten anybody any good this year. They only have one really quality win the whole season. So LSU is a much better team than Notre Dame. And Charlie Weiss, I think, will have a great team in 2 or 3 years, but not right now.
I think that about does it for the major bowls, although I'm sure many people in various places would disagree with me on that. But anyway, which of the other 27 or so bowls, the Meineke, the Bell Helicopters, the PapaJohns.com, et cetera, will you be paying attention to?
Well, look, you got to love the Poinsettia Bowl.
Poinsettias are nice.
The Meineke Car Care Bowl. You know, nothing says higher education like Meineke Car Care. You know, there should be some interesting bowls. I think one that's going to be a very good game is the Capital One Bowl, the Credit Card Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
Arkansas against Wisconsin should be a terrific matchup on the field if that's kind of what you're looking for. And I think the Texas Bowl, which features no team from Texas, but Kansas State against Rutgers. Rutgers is sort of a darling team of the country. They came out of nowhere to have a great season, and that's one I think you kind of want to watch just because of what Rutgers did this year. Usually the best games come out of nowhere. They call it Feast Week or Bowl Week or whatever on ESPN, and there's games, three games a day, and out of nowhere some crazy game will happen. It'll be 49-48, and I guess that's the joy of the bowl season.
Dan Wetzel covers college football, among other things, for Yahoo Sports. Dan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill.
As Dan Wetzel points out, the Boise State Broncos will face the Oklahoma Sooners in the Fiesta Bowl on New Year's Day, marking the first bowl championship series game for Boise State. The Broncos are the underdog heading into the Fiesta Bowl, but as reporter Sadie Babbitts found out, the 12-0 team does not suffer from lack of confidence.
Thousands of Boise State fans clad in orange and blue cheer as images of the Broncos flash across TV monitors. It's a Sunday night, and the university's basketball court has been transformed into the scene of a party. Everyone's here to watch the national TV broadcast announcing bowl championship series matchups.
Speaking of screaming, there's a bunch of people screaming at me to get the selection, so here we go. It's time to get the PCL.
The gymnasium erupts when it becomes official. Boise State's football team is heading to Phoenix to take on the Oklahoma Sooners in the Tostitos Fiesta Bowl on New Year's Day. Cheerleaders toss bags of chips into the stands as fans don sombreros and hold out signs like Boise State Broncos, all that, and a bag of chips. Starting quarterback Jared Zabransky takes to the podium as the crowd comes to its feet.
You know, there's going to be a lot of people out there that are going to doubt these Boise State Broncos. But you know what? When we walk into Arizona, we walk to that stadium 40,000 strong, including 110 men in blue. We're going to go out there with that chip on our shoulder, play with extreme confidence, and flex our muscles on.
Boise State's Broncos have already flexed their muscles. The team went 12-0 this season, and in doing so, grabbed the Western Athletic Conference title. Head coach Chris Peterson says it was their final away game against Nevada that clinched the BCS deal.
It was an awesome day for us. You know, we were over in Nevada. We had about probably 8,000 fans there. And after the game was over, all the fans stormed the field like it was their field. And it was kind of unexpected. You know, they turned it into kind of our home field.
Starting quarterback Jared Zabransky says the Broncos are successful because the team is uncommonly close.
Our team chemistry is unbelievable. Everybody's friends with everybody. We have 22 seniors that, you know, known each other for 5 years. You know, it's kind of like a brotherhood that we all had, and our team's like a huge family.
The Broncos put in 20 hours each week practicing on the field, lifting weights, and meeting with coaches. Coach Peterson says just showing up to practice doesn't cut it anymore. If you want to play, you have to be committed.
They'll spend 20 hours with us, but all of our team, these guys, they all go above and beyond, and they'll spend, you know, a couple hours on their own watching tape during the week, you know, videotape studying the opponents and maybe staying out there a little extra after practice. And that's where the love of football comes in, because if you don't truly love it, you're not going to do those extra things that we feel kind of put you over the top.
The Broncos' success also comes down to taking every game seriously. Take, for example, the last home game on November 18th against Utah State.
Second down and six.
The Broncos defeated the Aggies 49-10, and the Broncos' average margin of victory this season was 23 points. Still, they came close to losing their BCS bid on November 11th when they took on San Jose State and won on a last-second field goal, 23-20. By far, though, the Oklahoma Sooners will be their toughest opponent. That doesn't shake Jared Zebranski.
I foresee it. You know, we just continue to prepare like we are and, you know, focus on this game and focus on execution. And, you know, I think we have a very good chance of winning a football game no matter who we play.
Whether the Broncos win or lose on January 1st, Boise State has had a spectacular season, a fact not lost on head coach Chris Peterson.
We've had more NFL scouts probably spending more time here than they ever have since I've been here. And we do. We just have some really unique players that, you know, are going to have a chance to play at the next level.
Players including Zebranski, punter Kyle Stringer, and linebacker Corey Hall. But for now, the Broncos are focused on the short-term goal of winning the Fiesta Bowl.
It's an accumulation of so much hard work here that has started long ago. We will play well, and we will compete very hard. I mean, I can say that.
For Only a Game, I'm Sadie Babbitts in Boise, Idaho.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, ping pong diplomats enjoy a warm U.S. welcome 35 years after helping to thaw East-West relations. But first, Super Mario, Gary Bettman, and a cast of promising young hockey players have so far failed to restore the Pittsburgh Penguins' confident waddle, not to mention the team's Stanley Cup aspirations or its solvency. There has been speculation for years that the franchise, which has struggled on the ice and at the gate, would relocate if it couldn't find the funds for a new stadium, but the team might be bailed out by a casino company. Here to discuss the possible marriage of hockey and slot machines is Scott Burnside of ESPN.com. Scott, welcome back to Only a Game.
Well, thank you for having me.
Let's start by having you describe how this team that won back-to-back Stanley Cups back in 91 and 92 got into its current predicament.
Well, it really is, at the most basic level, a team that does not have the proper facilities in which to play in the National Hockey League, both in terms of comfort for fans and in terms of space and amenities to attract corporate sponsors and the like, the lifeblood of all professional teams, and certainly no different than the National Hockey League. And the Mellon Arena is the oldest arena in the NHL. It has been essentially falling down around the Pittsburgh Penguins for years and has contributed in no small way to their dire financial predicaments in the past decade. They have emerged in some ways from those financial problems, but the major issue confronting the team's future is who will build them a new arena. And the Isle of Capri and the rest of the gambling groups that are lobbying for the opportunity to run slots parlors in Pittsburgh, the Isle of Capri has agreed that if they are selected to run the gambling operation, that they will build an arena for the Pittsburgh Penguins and their fans and their new owner, Jim Balsillie. And the future will be bright if that's the case. But that's not assured, and so the future, as always with the Penguins, is not assured either.
In order for the deal that you've spoken about to materialize, the Isle of Capri has to be awarded a slots license by the Pennsylvania Gaming Control Board. We will know on December 20th whether that action materializes. What's the likelihood that the license is approved?
I'm not sure it's assured at all. There are a number of different groups that are in line for this license. There are varying reports on revenue projections and whether the Isle of Capri is either overestimating their projections on what they might be able to produce revenue-wise. And I'm not sure anyone really knows. And that's the interesting part, because without the Isle of Capri, the new owner of the Penguins, Jim Balsillie, the man who invented the BlackBerry, is not beholden to either the city of Pittsburgh or the Pittsburgh Penguins fans to keep the team there. And that's why December 20th is a real watershed moment for the team, for the National Hockey League, and perhaps for the first time in a long time, the movement of a franchise within that league.
If the license for slot machines doesn't come through, is there a plan B for Mr. Balsillie to keep the team in town, or is this going to be a death knell as far as Pittsburgh hockey fans are concerned?
That's the interesting part, as far as all are concerned, because the only contractual obligations Mr. Balsillie is under is if Isle of Capri, if they are the ones who are awarded. There is a school of thought within the hockey world that Mr. Balsillie will not be disappointed if the Isle of Capri is not successful, which would then give him leverage to take the team somewhere else, whether it's Kansas City or Houston or the favorite location amongst the hockey whisperers, Southern Ontario, which is where Mr. Balsillie is from.
Would the team be better off in one of those other three or four locations?
That's a disappointing part, I suppose, because Pittsburgh really is a terrific hockey town. They're approaching their 40th anniversary in the league. They've had, as you noted, terrific teams, championship teams. They've had some of the most exciting players in the National Hockey League. So if you looked at the group of teams in the NHL right now, you could probably pick five or six teams that are in less prominent positions in their communities. So there are other teams you probably would like to see move before the Pittsburgh Penguins. But the Penguins arena deal is critical. It's the most critical of all the situations in the NHL. And Mr. Balsillie has very, very deep pockets. And if his will is to move that team, if the Isle of Capri is not successful, then the league and the fans may be in for a battle to keep the team in Pittsburgh.
The National Hockey League's commissioner, Gary Bettman, has stated that he supports the Isle of Capri deal. Given the alleged involvement of former NHL player and assistant coach Rick Tocchet in a New Jersey gambling operation, does it surprise you that the commissioner of the league is anxious to go into partnership with a company that makes its money from gambling?
Well, if you're looking for strange bedfellows, you don't need to look very far in sport, but certainly there is some issue about it. Now, it would be a much more dicey, if you'll have that expression, situation if a team was going to up and move to Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
Even though a number of general managers at the Board of Governors meetings this weekend in Florida suggested that Las Vegas might indeed be one of the finest places to move a franchise, given its healthy economy and a lot of corporate money there. But there are certain, I guess, some questions you might ask about it, although with a slots situation, I'm not sure it's all that much different than government-subsidized lottery promotions, some which involve betting on hockey games themselves. So I'm not sure the slots and Rick Tocchet are necessarily tied together in a neat little bow.
During the 90s, many American pro sports teams convinced lawmakers that new stadiums should be publicly funded. Now that the public funds have more or less dried up, are we seeing the beginning of what could be a new trend in stadium financing, assuming this slot machine deal in Pittsburgh works out?
I mean, I guess you can start to look down the road and see, well, at what cost socially do we see these buildings built on the backs of slots, parlors, or casinos, or the like? But I'm not sure it's any different than if a brewery or a liquor company wants to be a major sponsor of a sporting team or a sporting venue or a sporting event. There, I'm sure there will be some people who will find a moral reason to object, but I think instead of hitting taxpayers where they live, that communities are going to want to explore as creative possibilities as there are to lessen the burden on the taxpayers while keeping the teams in their communities.
Scott Burnside covers the NHL for ESPN.com. Scott, thanks very much for talking with me.
Anytime.
On a recent tour of the United States, the Peking University table tennis team came in second place at the North American Teams Championship and played exhibitions at colleges on both coasts. But it wasn't just table tennis on display. As Only a Game's Karen Given reports from Wellesley, Massachusetts, students got a lesson in history as well.
It's 15 minutes before the Peking University table tennis team is scheduled to arrive, and the three rows of temporary bleachers set up in the sports center at Wellesley College are already filled to capacity. Most of the crowd is Asian, which isn't surprising for a table tennis event at Wellesley College. More than a quarter of Wellesley's students are of Asian descent, but according to physics professor Yu Hu, not all of them fully understand the significance of today's event.
Yes, this student of mine and I told her about this visit and the team and the ping pong diplomacy, and she thought for a minute. She said, "Do you mean to tell me I wouldn't be here if it weren't for the ping pong diplomacy?" I said, "Yes, precisely." And I thought, oh, wow, my children wouldn't be here if it weren't for the ping pong diplomacy.
35 years ago, Professor Hu was a young girl living near Shanghai when ping pong diplomacy hit the news. Since the communist takeover in 1949, there had been no official ties between the U.S. and China. But in April of 1971, during the World Championships in Japan, the United States table tennis team received an unexpected invitation. Would they like to visit China? The team went, and the following year, President Nixon followed. The events made a huge impression on Professor Hu, a third grader at the time.
I remember when Nixon came, it was a big deal, even though we were very far away from Shanghai, the city. We were all drilled and drilled and drilled what you're supposed to say if you ever run into an American reporter, because they're very, very tricky. First of all, you shouldn't go out. And if you did go out and did run into an American reporter, and this is what you're supposed to say: the American people are all very good, and the politicians, maybe not. Nixon was good because he came to China.
As soon as they start warming up, it's apparent that the Peking University students are very good at table tennis. The ball flits impossibly quickly from side to side. The crowd is wowed, and the players look almost bored. Soon, the real fun begins. The fans are invited to grab their paddles and test their skills against the Chinese players. While students from local colleges line up at two side courts, Tim Kelly takes center court against Liang Gilang, the coach of Peking University's team. Both men are in their 50s, but they manage some amazing shots. It's no surprise. Tim Kelly is the current over 50 North American hardback champion and in training for next week's U.S. Nationals. And Liang Gilang, he won 4 out of 5 world championships in the 1970s, and he has no trouble giving Kelly a workout.
I am out of breath. He's a legend. He's like Babe Ruth of table tennis. So it's quite an honor. I thank him for the honor.
It's not just a string of world championships that makes Liang Gilang a legend. It's also his involvement in ping pong diplomacy. Tim Kelly offers details.
He was part of it, you know. He was on a bus, Liang Gilang, when Glenn Cowan, a long-haired hippie-type table tennis player in the world championships in Osaka, Japan, ran on the bus. This was a moment. He had a gift for the Chinese team. They felt so moved. They gave him a gift. They invited the U.S. team to come to China.
Like all good legends, this tale has taken on several lives of its own. One version suggests that Glenn Cowan got on the Chinese bus accidentally, but the doors closed and the bus began to move before he could get off. Yet another version says Cowan was practicing at the tournament site with none other than Liang Gilang when he missed the U.S. team bus and had to get a ride back to the hotel from the Chinese. Whatever the story, when Cowan emerged from the Chinese team bus, he was photographed holding a silk screen of the Wanshan Mountains, given to him by a Chinese player. Later, the president of the Chinese Federation approached U.S. Federation official Ruford Harrison and asked how the U.S. team would react to an invitation to visit China. Harrison told that story in 2003 on New Hampshire Public Radio's Front Porch.
My personal reaction was down inside. I was jumping up and down and saying, gee whiz, this is great. After all, we had been isolated for 22 years. there was invective going back and forth for all those 22 years. We were lickspittles of capitalism, and our allies were our running dogs, and they were red commie bastards, you know, that sort of thing. And I'm not exaggerating. This was in the newspapers all the time.
Harrison is convinced that there was nothing coincidental or spontaneous about the Chinese offer. About a month earlier, Nixon had quietly removed the travel ban to China, and although table tennis, by far the most popular Chinese sport, might have been the government's first choice, it wouldn't have been the last.
Oh, but it wasn't a table tennis tour, it was a political tour. Don't let the table tennis aspect of it fool you. Notice, too, that the careful words of the invitation, it wasn't an invitation. It didn't say, we're inviting you to come to China. He said, how would you react to an invitation? They had a pretty good idea we'd react favorably. But if we'd have turned it down, there would have been no invitation, and they would have tried again with a badminton team or something else.
Back at Wellesley College, Liang Yilang poses for photos with fans and shows off the paddle he designed himself. Liang is proud of his involvement in ping pong diplomacy. It's made him a celebrity at home and abroad. But this trip is as much about looking back 35 years as it is about looking forward to the 2008 Summer Olympics in Beijing.
Absolutely, we're waiting for a long time, you know.
Yeah,
for Chinese people, it's really a big affair. We welcome, you know, to the people around the world to get to know, get to learn the real China, what it looks like. Yeah, he also would like to invite you to come into Beijing in 2008 to see what it's really like.
Since 1971, China has been using sports to invite the world to visit. But before this trip, Liang Yilang and his delegation sent word that they didn't want to discuss the current diplomatic relations between the U.S. and China. So does Professor Yu Hu think that third graders are once again being taught what to say to tricky American reporters?
I doubt it. I doubt you can do that anymore.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Wellesley, Massachusetts.
The holiday season is upon us, and that means it is the season of holiday parties, and at one of the parties to which I've been invited, there will be a raffle to benefit charity. I will enter the raffle because I am for charity, but I hope I don't win the raffle because the prize is a weekend at a ski resort. I have nothing against ski resorts. I understand that some of them serve excellent hot chocolate. But if I win the trip to the ski resort, I'll be expected to ski. And because this ski resort is located adjacent to a mountain, I will be expected to ski downhill. Once, when I was young and foolish, I rode an old-fashioned T-bar toward the top of a mountain. I was not good at it. In fact, I fell off the T-bar about three-quarters of the way up the run. I flopped onto the track where, unaccustomed to having skis attached to my feet, I flailed about helplessly until I'd knocked half a dozen other people off the T-bar. They were unhappy, since my accident meant they'd be deprived of a complete run. In fact, unhappy does not begin to describe what they were. I was secretly delighted, since skiing down the mountain from three-quarters of the way up seemed less dangerous than starting at the top. Once upright, I looked to the guy who'd convinced me to ride the T-bar in the first place. He had said he would teach me to ski. "Just follow me and do what I do," he said, as he turned gracefully and skied straight down the mountain. I turned awkwardly and fell on my face. Small children zipped by me, laughing. So did old people. Then came more small children. Sometime later, I arrived at the bottom of the mountain. I was hungry, thirsty, tired, and in some pain, but I knew I had to take care of something before I addressed any of these problems. I hobbled to the shed where I'd rented my skis and boots and returned them. I explained to the man behind the counter that they didn't work. "What?" he asked. "Shut up," I explained. I'm certain that the updated models to which winning the raffle would entitle me wouldn't work either. So may many people buy tickets, and may the charity enjoy its bounty, but please, Santa, may I not win. ¶¶ It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at CabotCheese.com. This is
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, bass fishing meets golfing in sunny Southern California. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Barry Bonds will get his chance to break Henry Aaron's career home run record in San Francisco. The Giants will apparently sign him to a one-year deal worth at least $16 million. Do the Giants get a good return on their investment, you think?
No, probably not. He'll be injured a lot this year, and then they'll have the entire circus of waiting for Barry to break the record and the kind of desultory lack of celebration there will be when he finally does. They've essentially volunteered for a freak show for this year.
Chicago Cubs general manager Jim Hendry underwent an angioplasty on Wednesday night. Then he returned to work bright and early the next day and signed free agent pitcher Ted Lilly while he was still, this is the general manager, not Ted Lilly, hooked up to an EKG monitor. That's dedication.
That's really dedication, and I don't want it to cause Mr. Hendry any undue post-operative stress, but $40 million over 4 years for Ted Lilly? Are you out of your freaking mind?
Dwight Gooden may return to the Yankees next season. Is George Steinbrenner overreacting to the Red Sox possible signing of Daisuke Matsuzaka, or is there another motive here?
Well, he's supposed to be a special advisor. This is George Steinbrenner, you know, feeling the faint voice of Marley's ghost in his ear this time of season, I think. And while there are prisons and while there are workhouses, he doesn't want Dwight Gooden in either one of them, although it can be argued that Yankee Stadium under George Steinbrenner can be both.
More evidence that mankind is his business, in fact. The Dallas Cowboys, who will host the New Orleans Saints tomorrow night, have won four games in a row. But regarding at least one player, that success can't be attributed to Coach Parcells' pep talks. The player wouldn't be Terrell Owens, would it?
I think pep talks are overrated both in history and in practice. I think pep talks to professional football teams require a certain level of, shall we say, dosage before the players actually get enthusiastic about them. But if you're Terrell Owens and you're a franchise wide receiver and a famous football player, don't talk about falling asleep during them. I mean, give Bill a little credit. Well, he worked really hard. He stayed up till 11 o'clock at night, making sure he kept the profanity out of it, making sure it was one that would stand with Lincoln at Gettysburg and Rockne before the Army game. And what does this guy say? I can't remember what he said. I had my mind on the party.
In tomorrow night's game, the Saints will be without defensive tackle Hollis Thomas. The asthma medication Mr. Thomas takes set off the league's drug alarms. Legitimate suspension?
Well, no, of course not. But that's because the entire steroid frenzy is illegitimate at its heart. He's taking a product called Advair twice a day while using an inhaler four times a day. There's at least one steroid in it, and and while it's possible it's a false positive, it's more likely the guy's asthma medicine. Give him a break. Good Lord.
Charlie, I can see how pro football players might be discouraged that their union hasn't achieved more in terms of guaranteed contracts, health care once they've retired, and pension benefits, just to name a few things. But was New York Giants linebacker LeVar Arrington accurate in his characterization of the union this week?
Well, he was a bit imprecise. He compared the way the NFL Players Association operates with organized crime, when actually the way the NFLPA operates is more like the corrupt unions that are tied to organized crime.
A small mistake.
Exactly. I think probably as he goes along through this controversy, he'll get a little bit better finessing it. It's all about his agent, who was suspended without a hearing for the NFLPA in specific. But in general, it's part of a little bit of low rumbling around the NFL among players who are smart and aware and realize that Gene Upshaw is a little bit too close to the league. It's got Bryant Gumbel into a little trouble this year. He lost his chance to work for the NFL Network because he criticized Gene Upshaw. And I think players should look at that and say, wait a minute, a house network for the National Football League has fired a guy for ripping the head of the players' union. Why should the NFL's house network care about who runs the players' union? The answer is, he got him like a yo-yo. And the fact is that these are the athletes that need guaranteed money,
absolutely,
that need health care, and that need the benefits of a union far more than anyone else does, and they have less of all of that.
What do you make of the latest BCS bawling, belly aching, and bereavement, Charlie?
Well, it's not as much fun as back when we just had straight bowl games and we had two or three national champions you could argue over, but this isn't bad. I gotta give him credit. I frankly would rather still to this moment prefer to see Southern Cal and Ohio State play just for horses for courses sake. But, you know, now you've got Florida and Ohio State. I think Florida is probably going to lose that game by 3 touchdowns.
Did you ever think that the day would come when the football coach at Rutgers University would turn down the job at Miami?
That's a really wonderful way to put it. Greg Schiano has decided to stay in Piscataway, New Jersey. The Miami job is a coach killer at this point. They don't know what they want. They succeeded by cheating. They don't really want to cheat, but if you don't cheat at Miami, you don't win, and they really want to win, too. I don't know who's going to go down there and take that job, but I don't give them 5 years in it.
If Texas Tech beats Centenary this afternoon, Bob Knight will replace Dean Smith as the winningest men's basketball coach, and he'll be only 4 wins behind Tennessee's Pat Summitt. Do you think he'll stay on the job until he can pass her?
He'll stay on the job until he has a very large number he can wave over his little pinhead and decide he's the greatest basketball coach who ever lived. Congratulations, Bob. I'm sure there'll be a lovely parade in Lubbock. The rest of us don't care.
NBA Commissioner David Stern acknowledged this week that the introduction of the new basketball was mishandled. See, it's funny because he said that the ball
mishandled.
Was mishandled.
I got it. Oh, you don't get. There's not a single cheap joke that gets by old David Stern, is there?
Or
I
me?
Or you, actually. Yeah, he's taking responsibility for it. Basically, he's saying he should have asked the people who have to like entertain paying customers with this silly thing, and they're going to do it. They'll fix it up.
The post-Olympic career of Carl Lewis having fallen flat. Nobody in this country has paid much attention to Mr. Lewis for some years, but that may be about to change.
Ah, Ben Johnson's bringing him back. They're going to go touring, I think. Ben Johnson has claimed that Carl Lewis was part of a conspiracy to sabotage the drug sample at the 1988 Olympics that cost Ben his gold medal. Apparently, he believes that minions, henchmen in the employ of Carl Lewis,
not to say druids,
spiked a beer in the drug testing area, which caused him to test positive for stenazolol. He's been talking to his lawyer, and he's trying to keep it as low as possible until next June because they're trying to make the guy talk. Now, I think we should all be very, very quiet while Ben goes hunting the steroid guys.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. His most recent book is Moving the Chains, Tom Brady and the Pursuit of Everything. And he joins me at this time each week on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
If you perchance have a predilection, a penchant, or even a passion for podcasts, please proceed to onlyagame.org and press podcast. The Best American Sports Writing 2006 includes boxing stories and bicycling stories, football stories and fishing stories, stories of coaches and stories of cheerleaders. Glenn Stout has been the series editor for Best American Sports Writing since 1991 when Houghton Mifflin revived the anthology, and he joins me now from the studios of Vermont Public Radio in Colchester. Glenn, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill.
And welcome as well to Charlie Schroeder, who joins us by telephone. Charlie is the author of one of the stories featured in the 2006 collection, and he has also contributed stories to this program. Charlie, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you very much for having me.
Glenn, in your foreword, you write that while you once believed the stories you read were true unless you had a specific reason to think otherwise, you now question everything and look for reasons to believe. Why the change in attitude?
Well, I think the change stems from, you know, some very real problems that have taken place in journalism over the last 4 or 5 years. So I think it's, you know, part of my responsibility as the editor of this book to, as much as I can, make sure that stories are true. And I think as a result of that, I've started to listen a little more closely for, you know, rings of authenticity in stories. And I've started to question sometimes stories that just seem a little too smooth for their own good. And I think that's all for the better.
Charlie, your story is about a guy who sneaks onto golf courses and fishes in water hazards at night. Were you worried that Glenn might think you were making this stuff up?
No, you know, it's funny because the idea originally came to me. A friend of mine who was an actor was in North Carolina, and he was shooting a film, and he had a lot of time in between shoots, and he said that he would go to golf courses. You know, when you play golf, you're always seemingly spending 5 hours on the golf course thinking about things you shouldn't be thinking about. And he said, I can spend my time doing better things here. So he brought with him a collapsible rod and started fishing actually during the daytime in between shots. And when I heard about that, I just thought, what better way to spend your time on the golf course than fishing? So I sort of followed my nose around, and lo and behold, I came up with people that did it at all hours of the day, and it's a fairly common practice.
See, you give me this image, and all I can think about is the guys playing behind the fisherman saying, four, you son of a gun, what are you doing out there?
The question that I always get is, people aren't eating these things, are they? And of course, you know, with all the chemical runoff, I don't think you want to put something like that into your mouth.
Glenn, in his introduction to Best American Sports Writing 2006, guest editor Michael Lewis contends that sports is, quote, the one thing Americans can be relied upon to feel passionately about. He may be right, but I don't feel good about that, do you?
Well, hopefully that's not the only thing that they're passionate about. I mean, you know, it is sort of the silly season with sports, and I think we all like to have it as a pastime and occasionally to treat it seriously. But I will, you know, agree with him in this, is that I think it's good that sports is one of the few things that we can share with people that perhaps we can share nothing else with, you know, other than the weather. But you can generally talk to someone about some kind of sport. I mean, even if I'm a deep sea fisherman, I can probably talk to Charlie about throwing a line in a golf pond looking for bass. There's something that unites people in those kinds of pursuits. I mean, I think any fisherman, for example, has some appreciation for any other kind of fisherman.
I want to read the beginning of one of my favorite stories in this edition. It's by J.R. Moringer, and it's titled The Unnatural Natural, and it begins, I checked my watch and peered into the distance. I was starting to think he'd never show. I was starting to think he didn't exist. In a way, I was right. Glenn, did you know four sentences into that story that it would make the book?
You know, sometimes you do, and in JR's case, that's the second time it's happened, because he had a story a number of years ago that I felt the exact same way about. You know, it reminds me of something W.C. Hines once said, I think, in an interview with you, where for him, the most difficult part of any story was the first sentence, because he looked at it like a piece of classical music, and you had to get the right chords. And this is a case where I think this story by J.R. has the right chords. And once you strike that right chord at the beginning, well, then you're just filling in the blanks until the end and letting the story unfold naturally and beautifully, and I think it does.
I'll second that and say that the second hardest line to write is the last line. Everything else in between is a breeze.
Well, Charlie, speaking of beginnings, your story begins with a hint of mystery. We've got a guy in a camouflage jacket is pacing in the almost empty parking lot. It could be the beginning of a story of a drug deal or an assassination, but no.
No, well, you know, Los Angeles is the type of place where to get to any decent type of lake could take you days with all the traffic. The idea of an urban fishing pond, while it may be illegal, is
and poison
is a pretty good alternative to sitting in traffic for 5 hours.
Charlie, as a, you know, you were a contributor to Only a Game, so of course the question I have to ask is, how come this story didn't slide our way before it made it all the way to Best American Sports Writing?
I was under the impression that it would be rejected if I pitched it. It was a funny story the way it happened. A friend of mine works for the L.A. Times, and I spoke to him, and I said, what are the chances of getting a piece in the Los Angeles Times? He said, absolutely no chance. So I sent him the pitch anyway, and within a day, it had gone from the outdoors section to the magazine, and now he's upset with me because he says even I can't get something into the magazine. So it was kismet, what can I say?
Well, I thought you were going to say, I didn't submit it to you guys because radio stuff isn't eligible for Best American Sports Writing, and that's what I was shooting for.
I can say that if you'd like. Well, I'm sure if I took all of the radio work that I've done for Only a Game and put it into the written word, that they would all be accepted for the best American sports writing.
Charlie, I assume you've had a chance to at least glance at Best American Sports Writing 2006. Have you a favorite among the stories aside from your own?
Oh, yes. In fact, I read Tim Zimmerman's piece. It's called Raising the Dead, and it's about cave divers in South Africa go into a place called Bushman's Hole. And I can honestly say that from the first word to the last word, my palms were sweating as if I was being hung upside down out of a skyscraper. It was such a well-written story and such a captivating tale of these death-defying divers. It really humbled me, to say the least, and to be included in a book with a piece of writing that good, it's a phenomenal piece.
Glenn, it occurs to me that since we've spent some time talking about a story about a guy fishing on a golf course, a story about deep sea divers recovering a body, we should probably mention there are some stories about sports that people are familiar with in the book, too.
Yeah, I mean, we don't ignore things like, you know, football and baseball, you know. They're in there, too. You know, but it's funny because I was thinking about this earlier. You know, when we have a story like Charlie's that's about, you know, fishing and an odd type of fishing, and then that makes me think that, you know, even in terms of something like football, it's like the NFL is not all there is to football. If the NFL were to stop playing tomorrow, that's only an infinitesimal amount of the football that's being played in the world at any one time. So, you know, it doesn't need to be the NFL or Major League Baseball or the NBA. There are so many people participating in so many sports today and so many people writing about them that there is no way of telling from one year to the next exactly what's going to pop up.
Glenn Stout is the series editor for the Best American Sports Writing series, and he joined me from the studios of Vermont Public Radio. Glenn, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thanks again, Bill.
And we've also been hearing from Charlie Schroeder, writer, actor, radio producer, and former golf instructor. He joined us from California. Charlie, thanks very much.
Thanks, Bill.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Elias Feldman and from Sam Sanders at Vermont Public Radio. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about Best American Sports Writing, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Best American Sports Writing 2006 contributor Charlie Schroeder and from the series editor Glenn Stout. They discuss the arduous annual sports essay selection process.
Usually I've read them all by the time the book is published.
Well, he clearly didn't read mine.
Things have certainly changed since last century. When I edited that dang book, I read everything.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. CityYear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, exploring how technology is changing kids and learning at digitallearning.macfound.org.